From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, inside the Bush administration, in the days following the September 11th attacks, we talk with journalist Bob Woodward about his new book, Bush at War, and we'll discuss the administration's handling of the UN resolution on Iraq and the internal disagreements about it. Also, we meet British actor Jeremy Northam. He recently starred in Gosford Park, Possession, and Enigma. This Sunday, he portrays Dean Martin in the CBS movie Martin and Lewis. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Missy Elliott's new CD, Under Construction. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The NATO alliance voted unanimously today to support the United Nations resolution calling on Iraq to disarm. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the NATO summit in Prague.
The NATO statement backs the effort to disarm Saddam Hussein, but it does not commit the alliance to lending military support, should that be necessary to enforce the UN resolution. Still, the White House is calling this a victory, and the president is counting on plenty of support from individual NATO countries, should there be a war. For now, the administration says publicly it still hopes Iraq will disarm peacefully, but National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice also had this assessment.
We're deeply skeptical that this regime is ever going to fully live up to the UN Security Council resolutions to which it signed.
By December 8th, Iraq must give UN inspectors a complete inventory of its weapons of mass destruction. The White House will not say if a failure to do so accurately will trigger a military response. Don Gagne, NPR News, with the president in Prague.
Also today, NATO voted to extend membership to Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Bulgaria, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia. U.S. officials recently said that a senior al-Qaeda leader had been captured. Today, they identified him as Abd el-Rahim al-Nashiri, the network's chief of operations in the Persian Gulf. They did not disclose any details of his capture. They suspect he helped plan the attacks on the USS Cole off Yemen and two U.S. embassies in East Africa. Two Palestinian groups have claimed responsibility for today's suicide bombing in Jerusalem. Police say a man blew himself up during the morning rush hour. 11 passengers were killed. An American missionary who worked as a nurse at a health clinic in southern Lebanon was shot to death today. There has been increased anti-American sentiment in the region. From Beirut, NPR's Kate Seeley reports.
Bonnie Penner was shot 3 times in the head by an unidentified assailant in the southern port city of Sidon. Police say the killing took place early in the morning at the health clinic where she worked, in a charity center run by an evangelical church. There was no claim of responsibility, and it was not clear whether the attack was politically motivated. But aid workers claimed the church had received warnings from local Muslim radical groups demanding that the center be closed down. Some Muslim clerics had accused it of trying to proselytize and indoctrinate Sidon's youth. Penner, a 31-year-old nurse, had been living in Lebanon 2 years. U.S. Embassy officials say they are investigating her killing with Lebanese authorities. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Beirut.
The rally on Wall Street continued today. The Dow closed up 222 points at 88.45 in heavy trading of 2 billion shares. The Nasdaq was up 48 points to 14.67, and the S&P finished the day at 9.33, up 19. This is NPR News. Stock prices may have moved higher because of 2 reports on the economy. The Conference Board said its index of leading economic indicators was flat last month after falling 0.4% in September. The index suggests where the overall U.S. economy is headed in the next 3 to 6 months. And the Labor Department said weekly jobless claims last month fell to their lowest level in 4 months. A federal grand jury in Salt Lake City has indicted a South Carolina man for allegedly pretending to be the kidnapper of missing Utah teenager Elizabeth Smart and seeking $3 million in ransom. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
18-year-old Walter Holloway of Charleston, South Carolina, is accused of emailing ransom demands and threats to police and to the uncle of Elizabeth Smart, who was abducted from her Salt Lake City bedroom in June. Prosecutors say there's no evidence Holloway was actually involved in Smart's disappearance, but he claimed he had her, they say, and threatened to harm Smart and her sister if a $3 million ransom demand was ignored. The demands were made in emails with the username Elizabeth Smart Kidnapper. Police say the emails were traced to Holloway's computer. A federal complaint says police barged in on Holloway while he was sending a threatening email. Conviction on counts of interstate extortion and sending threatening communications could result in prison sentences of up to 25 years. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
A jury in Manhattan today convicted a man of assaulting New York Yankees pitcher Dave Wells. Rocco Graziosa was found guilty of punching Wells during an early morning encounter at an Upper East Side diner in September. He could be sentenced to as long as a year in jail. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Michigan, whose $1 billion Michigan Life Sciences Corridor Initiative is bringing minds and research to Michigan. Information available at michigan.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Bob Woodward, has written a new book called Bush at War. It's a behind-the-scenes account of the Bush administration's first 100 days after September 11th. An epilogue covers more recent planning on how to deal with Iraq. The book is based on notes Woodward obtained from more than 50 meetings, including ones held by the National Security Council. Woodward interviewed more than 100 people involved in the decision-making and execution of the war and conducted two interviews with President Bush. In Woodward's 1991 book, The Commanders, he wrote about the lead-up to the Gulf War during the presidency of George H.W. Bush. Bob Woodward became famous for his investigative reporting after breaking the Watergate story with his colleague Carl Bernstein. Now, you report in your book that before the attacks, the Pentagon had been working for months on developing a military option for Iraq. Who was arguing, even before September 11th, that we should be trying to overthrow Saddam Hussein?
Well, I think it's been on the Bush administration agenda from the beginning, and a lot of people in the Pentagon, Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz, the Deputy Wolfowitz, and the Secretary Rumsfeld, very interested in doing something in Iraq. In fact, on the first night, the secret meeting in the White House, the day of 9/11, Rumsfeld said, should we use this as an opportunity to go after Iraq?
Now, what about Dick Cheney and Colin Powell? They were both leaders of the first Gulf War. They went after Iraq then. How did they feel about including Iraq on the Bush administration agenda before September 11th?
I think somewhat differently. As we know, and I think the book shows in more vivid detail, Vice President Cheney is a hardliner, a hawk. Powell, as was the case in the 1991 Gulf War, is the reluctant warrior. So there was a kind of latent tension before 9/11 within the administration, and that kind of set the stage for Iraq. But interestingly enough, what happened, Bush clearly decided in the first week after 9/11 that we were going to go after bin Laden and al-Qaeda and not Iraq. And when I talked to Bush twice, he kept emphasizing he knew he couldn't attack Iraq in the first phase of any war on terrorism.
Do you get the sense that any of the feelings about the importance of going after Saddam Hussein, if any of that has to do with aftermath from the Gulf War, you know, it's like, well, we didn't get him that time, so this time we're going to get him. And, you know, if in other words, is it personal at all?
I found no evidence of that.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to lots of people, looked at lots of notes of meetings and so forth, and I think it's in the back of people's minds, but the people, particularly Cheney and Powell and Bush's father, who was president during the Gulf War, feel they did the right thing. That if you look back and get into the details of this, you find that the UN resolution authorizing force in the Gulf War said the purpose is to eject Saddam Hussein and the Iraqis from Kuwait, which had been invaded and taken over by Saddam. That goal was achieved. It was not on the list of things to do at the time, go to Baghdad and overthrow the regime. And so as they look around and they say, we are the superpower, we have the capacity to remake the strategic world, and this man is a threat. He has violated UN resolutions for a decade. Let's think about going.
My guest is Bob Woodward, and his new book is called Bush at War. Now, President Bush was willing to go it alone if necessary in taking on Iraq. It was Colin Powell, who was the biggest force within the administration, to insist that we had to try to get a coalition, get UN support. How did Colin Powell win on that in the sense that, you know, President Bush made his address to the United Nations and ended up getting support for this round of inspections, of weapons inspections? What did Powell do to convince the president?
I think perhaps one of the most important dinners of recent history was August 5th at the White House, when Powell had asked for a private meeting with the president. That meant Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, would sit in, and Powell had actually drawn up a list of reasons why the president could not go to war alone. He actually said to the president, you may want to go alone, it may seem nice, but you can't. He then laid out essentially eight reasons why, in addition to kind of elaborating on the consequences of a war with Iraq, if the United States was doing it alone and did not operate with allies, some sort of coalition, or through the UN. It's a compelling argument. I lay it out in the book, and the president adopted it. There was lots of pushback from Cheney and Rumsfeld at various stages in this. Up to the last minute, September 12th, it was not absolutely clear what President Bush was going to do. The speech that he gave had 24 drafts, and the asking for new resolutions was in, was out of the speech. He finally agreed it would be in there, but it literally did not make it into the version that was in the teleprompter. He knew it was so important. When he saw that it was not there, he ad-libbed and said the United States would ask and seek new resolutions on Iraq. That was done, as we now know, and the Security Council passed those resolutions 15-0. So,
what was it like for Colin Powell to go it alone within the Bush administration? You say, for instance, that one of the big difficulties he had was that he was supposed to pretend in public that the differences within the war cabinet didn't really exist.
That's right. President Bush likes agreement and consensus, at least in public. Though he did, when I talked to him about this, the president said, I want people to have different points of view, and I want them to argue forcefully. He would like that to be done only in private, and then everyone salutes and comes out and says, we agree with the president's decision. The tensions on this issue go so deep, have to do with the worldview of the individuals, their sense of where we are in this moment in history, that it was almost inevitable that they surface.
What is Powell's attitude, if you know the answer to this, what is Powell's attitude about maintaining that public face of unanimity when he has to, even when he strongly disagrees with the Bush administration direction?
Well, he agrees on this. He won the day.
Right.
And it may be the most important issue, at least it appears now to be that, pending before the president and the National Security Council, and they are going his way on some other issues. Certainly in the first 18 months of the Bush administration, as I report, he felt somewhat isolated. He had never made the personal connection with the president, which Powell is kind of a specialist at. He has very strong personal connections with all kinds of people, as does the president. They just didn't get in step, in sync. Powell has worked on that relationship. I think it has improved, but there were moments when he used to joke with his deputy that he had been put in the refrigerator or the icebox, only to be brought out and used when needed by the White House.
My guest is Bob Woodward. He's written a new book called Bush at War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Bob Woodward is my guest. His new book is called Bush at War, and it's an inside look about what happened inside the Bush administration in the first 100 days after September 11th. But there's also information a little more recent than that about Iraq. Let's look at one of the issues shortly after September 11th, and that was how much should President Bush have emphasized bin Laden as like the central figure? And that was the subject of some debate within the Bush administration. What was the debate about? Who was on each side?
Well, it was particularly Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld who said, don't emphasize bin Laden. In fact, in the famous speech that the president gave to Congress on September 20th, 9 days after the terrorist attacks, Rumsfeld, up to the end, was saying, don't even mention bin Laden in that speech once. The president decided he had to and did mention him once. And, of course, as people may recall, he said publicly that he wanted bin Laden dead or alive. There was much emphasis on that when they didn't get bin Laden, and it was pretty clear he had escaped. And that perhaps he was dead. There was much less emphasis on him. In operational terms, the fact that we have been able to destroy the sanctuary that bin Laden had in Afghanistan, the fact that the CIA has rounded up or had foreign intelligence services or police forces in 80 countries round up thousands of terrorists, suspected members of bin Laden's organization, has put a crimp in the organization and certainly disrupted some terrorist plans. Now, I think there's much more disappointment that they haven't found bin Laden. Bush has a private scorecard in his desk where he X's out people when they're killed or captured, and Bush's tendency is to personalize things. I think he takes, it's bin Laden versus Bush. The fact that bin Laden has survived certainly the biggest manhunt in perhaps the history of civilization is frustrating to the president.
In doing the research for this book, did you learn anything that you didn't know before about what the Clinton administration had tried to do with bin Laden, or about if the Clinton administration was effective in passing off its information about bin Laden to the Bush administration?
The Clinton administration had done a lot, particularly through the CIA. They actually had a tracking team of paid Afghan agents in Afghanistan who were following bin Laden around and could report with some regularity where he was. They were not authorized to try to kill him or assassinate him, and there was an unwillingness to really even seriously consider that or do that. The same in the first 9 months of the Bush administration. They really never got an anti-bin Laden policy going, but it is the capacity the CIA had that was funded and created during the Clinton years that made, after 9/11, the rather remarkable on-the-ground effort by the CIA possible. And if there had not been that support or the money or the willingness to support some of the activities in Afghanistan, some of the covert work that was done, the Afghan war, at least the first phase of it, would not have gone the way it did.
Can you give us a sense about what the process is of the war cabinet meetings, like how the meetings are run, what the interactions are like between the people?
It starts off generally with the CIA director giving an intelligence update, or in the case of the war in Afghanistan, a progress report, what's going on. Then Secretary Powell would give a rundown on the diplomacy and what's going on in his area. Then Secretary Rumsfeld would give an account of the war or war plans. Those are the three main players in the war cabinet who have operational responsibility. Cheney, the vice president, tends to not say a lot, tends to speak at the end.
Is he there or is he on speakerphone?
No, he's there much of the time, but if he is off on off at his undisclosed location, he comes up on what they call CIVETS, which is a secure video conferencing system. So not only his voice, but his face is there. And Condi Rice tends to coordinate and think about what they're going to meet about next, and the president interjects. When I interviewed him, he said, you know, quite candidly, he said, sometimes I tend to be almost a gas bag at these meetings and go on and talk too much, and it's a bad habit, and I should stop it. He interjects and talks quite a bit, and one of the things I found, he's the ultimate decision maker. Dick Cheney is not running the government, though Dick Cheney is probably the most important overall advisor on these matters.
President Bush is well known for hating leaks, for liking to have unanimity among his people, and for being pretty tough with the press in terms of not revealing a lot of information. A lot of reporters have actually been complaining about how difficult it is to get information from the Bush administration. What were you able to learn about President Bush's process for maintaining that kind of public unanimous face and for trying to prevent leaks?
Well, he's pretty strong on it. At the same time, I was able to get a very unusual amount of information. I had the luxury of time to work for months and months on this. And when I sent him a 20-page memo outlining what I knew, said I wanted to talk to him, he sat for 2 hours and 25 minutes and answered up to 300 questions about what actually happened in the course of the war and some of the attitudes he had and where it came from. Was not resistant. He didn't deny a thing, and some of the issues were very sensitive. At the same time, he knew his voice would be included in this book and that I had a lot of very specific information, made the calculation for reasons I don't fully understand to answer the questions. And I think you ought to do more of that. I think the biggest fear in this country, particularly in a time of war, a time when there are so many threats out there, the biggest threat is secret government. And the less secret it is, the better off we all are, and ultimately the better off the government is.
In your interview with President Bush, what's one of the most surprising or telling things that he revealed to you?
Overall, that he has a vision of almost wants to remake the world, this idea that American leadership is going to be the shaping force in the world. As he said, I will seize the opportunity to achieve big goals. And he wants to be the liberator in countries where people are oppressed, maintains his goal is world peace, that he's concerned about mothers and starving children, and that there is a determination. And at one point he said, maybe it's my religion. Maybe it's just a gut instinct. Maybe it's visceral. But that he feels you either believe in freedom and worry about the human condition or you don't. And that he, it is an almost Woodrow Wilson-like view of creating a new world order and using his presidency for that purpose. I did not expect him to outline that.
Well, Bob Woodward, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bob Woodward's new book is called Bush at War. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coleman Hawkins was born 98 years ago today. Here's his classic recording of Body and Soul.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by this and other NPR member stations. By Universal Pictures, presenting The Emperor's Club, starring Kevin Kline. In every person's life, there is someone who makes all the difference. Now in theaters everywhere. And WorldCom. A financial update is now available at worldcom.com/update. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we meet British actor Jeremy Northam. He recently starred in Gosford Park, Possession, and Enigma. On Sunday, he plays Dean Martin, opposite Sean Hayes as Jerry Lewis, in the CBS movie Martin and Lewis. Also, Ken Tucker reviews Under Construction, Missy Elliott's fourth CD. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Missy Elliott has just released her fourth album titled Under Construction. Rock critic Ken Tucker says that the rhythms and production style Elliott has devised with her producer Timbaland take on added ambition with this new collection, which both looks back at hip-hop's past and ahead to its future.
Came to bring the pain, hardcore to the brain. Ooh, baby, what's your name? I love the way you spit in the game. You made me change from thinking all guys the same. You the type of guy I want to marry in months. Got exactly what I want. And ain't no faking the funk. Your attitude is funk and you're making me crunk. Yes.
Maybe you know Missy Elliott from her extravagantly surreal videos, filled with wild sci-fi costumes and showcases for her ample imagination. After hits like Get Your Freak On and her Moulin Rouge soundtrack cover of Lady Marmalade, Elliott might have turned into a novelty act. Instead, as the title of this collection announces, Elliott sees herself as a work that's under construction, and part of what that means is making a statement of principles. Throughout Under Construction, Elliott condemns the violent rhetoric that may have contributed to the murders of hip-hop artists from Tupac Shakur to most recently Run-DMC's Jam Master Jay. As she says just before the start of this beautiful piece of wistfulness, with guest vocal help from Jay-Z, let's just have fun. It's hip-hop, man.
Brothers and sisters! Brothers and sisters! I don't know what this world is coming to!
What's up, Missy? Timbo! I came from the gutter, no, I came from my mother, but you know what I mean. Hope it's here to stay like permanent crease in your jeans. Me and Missy be the new tag team. Woo, there it is. We like Ray and Ghost, AG and Showbiz. Republic enemy number one, our Uzi weighs a ton. This is a house run.
What happened to those good old days when hip-hop?
That song, Back in the Day, begins with a snippet of Jesse Jackson and ranges back across the whole history of hip-hop over the past two decades. It's a masterly sprawl with a subtle percolating beat by producer Timbaland. It runs beneath Missy's sweet vocals and the choral harmonies. Toward the end, she sings, I want to go back in time, and it doesn't come across as empty nostalgia, but as a vivid remembrance of how crucial this music has been to her life. On another cut called Gossip Folks, she has the wit to sample Frankie Smith's 1981 rap novelty hit Double Dutch Bus and give that wispy pleasure some emotional weight. Further into Under Construction, Elliott has established the mood, contemplative, tough and tender within a single verse, intensely romantic. The stage is set for a hip-hop ballad, which she pulls off on a duet with Beyoncé Knowles called Nothing Out There For Me.
My man don't like my friends.
Girl, your man ain't no good. Why he trying to keep you in?
He say they influence me.
If I was an influence, I'd have been said leave.
But boy, I love him so.
Girl, we late for the club. Why you still don't want to roll?
Because I got my prize right here.
See the guys at the party.
Ain't nothing out there for me.
Ain't nothing out there for me.
Okay.
This is where I want to be.
Okay.
I done already been in the streets. And I ain't came across nothing so sweet.
Okay.
He's the only man that I love.
Is that right?
I'm thinking about
I know he's in
insecure every time I leave out the door.
And you letting him spoil your night, live your life, you ain't even his wife.
He ain't gotta worry about me, cause I got something more sweet.
Oh, you must got a diamond ring.
And I know I'm so lucky, ain't nothing, ain't nothing
for me.
Okay.
For me.
We should never forget that her full stage name is Missy Misdemeanor Elliott. There's a lot of frank sex talk on Under Construction that would get her and I in trouble if we played it here, but for grown-ups, Elliott's raunch is part of her maturity as well. It's so rare to hear a hip-hop woman speak with such self-assurance and confidence about herself and her friends that the music, far from needing an Under Construction warning sign, sounds like a glimpse of a life that's a completed work of art.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Under Construction by Missy Elliott.
I've been checking on your moms and dad and your brother since the day you left. Left, passed on and went away with God. But for your mama, it's been
so damn hard.
I hate to even hear her cry. Aaliyah, she asked me why. Would a baby girl go this way? Can you give me better words to say?
Come one day, she'll see you again with the same old beautiful smile. Lost in the voice of a hummingbird. You'll be singing them same old songs. Aaliyah, can you hear me? I hope that you're proud of me. Me and Tim, we've been doing our thing. But it's never been the same since you had to go. Ain't never met a friend more incredible.
Coming up, actor Jeremy Northam. He plays Dean Martin in the new CBS movie, Martin and Lewis. This is Fresh Air.
After being out late, walking my baby back home, arm in arm over meadow and farm, walking my baby back home. We go along harmonizing a song, or I'm reciting a poem. Owls go by and they give me the eye, walking my baby back home. We stop for a while.
My guest Jeremy Northam plays Dean Martin in the CBS movie Martin and Lewis, which will be shown Sunday night. The movie is about the showbiz partnership of Martin and Jerry Lewis, with Lewis played by Sean Hayes of Will and Grace. Dean Martin's actual recordings are used in the film, Northam lip syncs, but he did his own singing in Gosford Park, in which he played a character based on the singer and songwriter Ivor Novello. Here's Northam and Hayes in a scene from the new TV movie shortly after Martin and Lewis meet. They're sharing the bill at a nightclub. After the show, Jerry Lewis has been goofing around with a table of customers. Then Martin takes him aside.
What the hell is wrong with you? You know who that is?
Some real nice fella, I hope.
Nice fella? That's Lucky Luciano. That's who that is. Murder Incorporated. You gotta know who you're talking to in these clubs.
So what do I do?
You pray. I'll talk to him. If you're still alive by the midnight show, it might mean he forgives you.
Jeremy Northam is a surprising choice for portraying Dean Martin. Northam is British, and he's best known for more formal period roles in such films as The Winslow Boy, The Ideal Husband, Possession, and Enigma, characters that are the opposite of Martin's cool. Northam told me that he wasn't very familiar with Martin's work with Lewis, so he caught up by watching their TV show and rare footage of their act at the Sands and the Copa. I asked Northam about the mannerisms and sensibility he picked up on for his portrayal of Dean Martin.
I looked at the physical side of things, thinking, well, how am I going to look like Dean? I don't look like Dean at all in my mind. I don't have the same sort of physical stature. I don't have the same physical history as he has. But I became obsessed with his hands, for instance. He had these enormous hands, and the knuckles were all broken from when he used to box for cash and never used to bind his hands properly. So his knuckles were all ruined, and he had these rather prominent, I thought, hands that he used in a very idiosyncratic way. So that became, that was the first thing that I really looked at. And then I wanted to find out what tunes they're going to use in the piece. They were rather undecided because they had to get clearance rights, of course. And they arrived rather late. And the reason behind that, I think the producers are rather puzzled by that. I demanded to have the sheet music. They said, well, why do you need that? And I said, because I want to learn the songs and then see what Dean does with them. You get a standard version on the sheet music and then hear how he changes the phrasing, maybe even sometimes the words, where he breathes and how he makes the very beautiful but idiosyncratic sound that he makes when he was singing, and therefore try and find the speaking voice. And so it goes on.
Now, you mentioned you wanted to see the sheet music so you could really understand what Dean Martin was doing with a song. And you wanted to use his singing style since the music was being dubbed and we actually hear his voice singing. You wanted to use that singing style to help you find your speaking voice when you were playing Dean Martin. Can you talk about finding that voice, what you took away from the singing and how you used that for the speaking?
Well, he had this, he had a quite a deep voice, but a very light vibrato at the top end of the voice. And the vowels are placed in a very particular way in the mouth, very different from mine. So had I been doing the singing as well, I don't think I would have gone as far as I did with the speaking voice, but because we had Dean's singing voice, I really had to go further than perhaps I would otherwise have done with a speaking voice. So,
because you had to get your speaking voice to match his singing,
as much as I could, and it's a fairly impossible task because I think only Dean Martin could make the sound that Dean Martin made. But I suppose it was just trial and error, really. And I always felt on set that I was going massively over the top, that it was way too much. And I don't know whether it is or whether it isn't, but it was interesting to try.
I'm thinking, like, who else has played both Dean Martin and Ivor Novello, the British singer who you played in the movie Gosford Park?
Funny mixture, isn't it? A gay Welsh composer and Italian singer from Steubenville, Ohio.
Yeah, well, a lot of people have seen Gosford Park, but not that many Americans really know who Ivor Novello was. So just describe who the character that you played, Ivor Novello, was in British music history.
As far as I can remember, I'm no great expert myself, but Ivor Novello was a bit of a prodigy when he was young. He wrote a famous First World War anthem, best known, I suppose, as Keep the Home Fires Burning. Actually, its real title is When the Boys Come Home. He was the child of a singer, and he became an actor, concert performer. He went to Hollywood. He didn't quite make it as an actor in Hollywood, although he performed in a film called The Lodger, which Hitchcock, one of the early Hitchcock movies. But he wrote in Hollywood as well. He wrote screenplays and was something of a script doctor. And he then performed in his own musicals, which were sort of like light operettas rather than American musicals, which he toured for years and years and was enormously popular. When he died in the 50s, his funeral was attended by hundreds of thousands of people, and people say that, to this day, that there were three hugely attended and very influential funerals of the 20th century in Britain. One was Winston Churchill's, one was Princess Diana's, and the other was Ivor Novello's. And he was, he's brought into Gosford Park as a device, really. Film is set in the early 30s when he was about to kick off really his musical theatre career, and the songs from that time fitted the period of the film very well.
Well, I want to play And Her Mother Came Too from the soundtrack of Gosford. Oh yeah, I really like it. This is from the soundtrack of Gosford Park. In the movie, you're at the piano, accompanying yourself. I don't imagine you actually played piano.
If you played one of the other tracks, no, actually, on the CD, it's all my brother playing the piano, and on the film, there's two tracks which I play and sing live, and the rest is my brother pre-recorded and then me singing live over the top. My brother's a professional pianist, and he's actually accompanied a lot of people doing a lot of novello down in the West Country in England, and so he was the perfect person to ask for it. It was the first time we ever worked together as well. It's very nice.
Did Robert Altman, the director of the film, know all this when he hired you?
No, there wasn't even a part written when I met him.
Oh. So he cast you before he even knew who you were going to play?
He said, I'm thinking of putting this character in there, this guy. You know, I think about Ivor Novello. And I gather that years and years ago, the film that was going to be, that turned out to be MASH, was actually initially a First World War story, believe it or not. So he'd done a lot of work, research for Ivor Novello for that original movie. And when MASH came along, he said, I could use everything that he'd been working on for this other script in MASH. And Ivor Novello was put on the shelf. And years later, he thought, that could be handy. So he invented this character based on Novello to appear at the country house in Gosford Park.
Okay, well, here's Jeremy Northam from the soundtrack of the film Gosford Park, singing the Ivor Novello song And Her Mother Came Too.
I seem to be the victim of a cruel jest. It dogs my footsteps with the girl I love the best. She's just the sweetest thing that I have ever known. But still we never get the chance to be alone. My car will meet her, and her mother comes too. It's a two-seater, still her mother comes too. At Ciro's when I am free, at dinner, supper, or tea, she loves to shimmy with me, and her mother does too. We buy her trousseau, and her mother comes too. Asked not to do so, still her mother comes too. She simply can't take a snub. I go and sulk at the club, then have a bath and a rub, and her brother comes too. We lunch at Maxim's, and her mother comes too. How large a snack seems when her mother comes too. And when they're visiting me, we finish afternoon tea. She loves to sit on my knee, and her mother does too. To golf we started, and her mother came too. Three bags I carted when her mother came too. She fainted just off the tee. My darling whispered to me, Jack dear, at last we are free. But her mother came too.
That's Jeremy Northam singing on the soundtrack of the film Gosford Park. Northam plays Dean Martin in the CBS movie Martin and Lewis, which airs Sunday night. We'll talk more with Northam after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. My guest is actor Jeremy Northam. He starred in The Winslow Boy, The Ideal Husband, Possession, Enigma, and Gosford Park. He plays Dean Martin in the CBS movie Martin and Lewis, which will be shown Sunday night. One of your early breaks came on the British stage when you were, I guess you were the understudy for Daniel Day-Lewis when he was playing Hamlet, and something happened.
Actually, you know, that wasn't a break.
It wasn't
all.
A break?
No, because it didn't. You know, it was I know everyone wants to think that it's like 42nd Street, but it really isn't.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
You know,
yeah.
He went out an understudy and came back a star. It's really not true. Nobody knew that I was going on. Everyone turned up at the theatre for 30-odd performances expecting to see Daniel Day-Lewis play the part, and unfortunately they found me there. I don't think anyone has ever cast me for another job on the basis of having seen me struggle my way through Hamlet.
Well, it sounds like you think the result was massive disappointment on the part of the audience.
I think it probably was, actually. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think I'd be pretty disappointed if I turned up to see Daniel Day-Lewis play Hamlet and got someone you'd never heard of.
Well, what happened? You know, I read articles about it, and the articles all say he had some kind of breakdown in the middle of the performance. I mean, what actually happened?
Well, he left the stage about half an hour into the show, and it was at the National Theatre in London. You know, there's three auditoria there, and there's several shows playing in each one at the same time. And I was playing the lead in a play called The Voysey Inheritance down in the Cottesloe. On certain nights, I was playing Captain Molyneux, which was a lead in the Shacrona play by a 19th century melodrama by Boucicault in the Olivier. I was playing Osric in Hamlet, understudying Hamlet, and at that time rehearsing Laertes, who was the current Laertes, was actually leaving the production soon, and a new Hamlet was being rehearsed in, Ian Charlson. So I was doing that by day, and I was just trying to get through the week, basically. We hadn't done a staged rehearsal of the play for 5 months. There was no indication that I was going to have to go on. So it came out of left field.
And so Daniel Day left in mid-performance, Daniel Day-Lewis?
Yes, he did.
And you had to go on in mid-performance. You must have been totally unprepared for that.
Yeah, and it was fairly ridiculous, I have to say. You know, it was...
How you've changed, Hamlet.
I really didn't want to go on. I don't think any of the cast wanted me to go on. And it was a bit of a one-sided fight between me and the text, and the text came out top. And you could hear the flipping of seats throughout the performance.
You mean people were walking out?
Because it was a long evening anyway, you know, made even longer.
Did you even remember your lines? I mean, there's so many.
Well, that was the problem. It wasn't so much remembering. It was the fact that there were so many of them, and they were so unfamiliar in my mouth. So there were many slips and fumbles, and it got better on subsequent nights. But it was one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. It became, after, you know, on subsequent nights, exhilarating and very exciting. At the time, it was just terrifying. Just as terrifying to the rest of the cast. I mean, since then, I've been in the same situation where people have unexpectedly gone on, and you have to carry on performing with somebody who's you've never acted with before, and you'd find yourself doing the classic thing of talking to one person downstage right, and then the answer would come upstage left because you'd forgotten that. That's where the reply came from. And as for knowing which was Rosencrantz and which was Guildenstern, well, forget it.
Now, I know one of the roles you have coming up now is The Singing Detective, which is a new movie based on the Dennis Potter TV series that played in the United States on public television a few years ago. And like Pennies from Heaven, in the TV series anyways, this is a story in which popular songs, older popular songs are used to express the innermost feelings that the characters are having, and they lip sync along to these records in these kind of...
And also the characters sort of place in the cultural scheme of things as well, enough and in a peculiar way.
Right, are sung. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Are determined.
Yeah, I didn't have to do any of that lip syncing. I got a very peripheral and interesting but small part in the movie. the lead's played by Robert Downey Jr., who plays the writer.
Oh.
And I play his the nemesis of his imagination, really, a character called Binny, who in... the story happens on several different levels, if people remember, from the TV series. The writer is locked inside his own body, covered with psoriasis in a hospital ward, and the only thing that's really working is his imagination. And to sort of keep him going, he translates the characters that are around him in his present life into characters in a kind of pulp fiction in his head. So I'm somebody who he imagines is having an affair with his estranged wife, and who he imagines is stealing his material from under his nose, and he becomes a sort of a low-life, double-dealing scum in this kind of 50s film noir in his head. So it's a strange kind of role, really existing in somebody else's imagination, but interesting.
Well, good. Good luck with the movie.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Jeremy Northam plays Dean Martin in the CBS movie Martin and Lewis. It airs Sunday night. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
When marimba rhythms start to play, dance with me, make me sway. Like the lazy ocean hugs the shore, hold me close, sway me more. Like a flower bending in the breeze, bend with me, sway with ease. When we dance, you have a way with me, stay with me, sway with me. Other dancers may be on the floor, dear, but my eyes will see only you. Only you have the magic technique. When we sway, I grow weak. I can hear the sound of violins long before it begins.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Book Magazine. In the current issue, editors pick their best of 2002, books, titles, and characters, in bookstores or at 800-317-2665. By Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of I, Richard by Elizabeth George, author of A Traitor to Memory, and Nonsuch Records and Travelogue, the new album by Joni Mitchell, a 2-CD set featuring new recordings of 22 songs spanning her entire career, accompanied by full orchestra. Available at Barnes & Noble. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Die Another Day, the new James Bond movie, is opening in theaters. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with composer John Barry. He wrote the Bond theme and the most memorable Bond songs, including Goldfinger and Thunderball. And we hear some eccentric jazz improvisations on James Bond scores from Stephen Bernstein of the group Sex Mob. Join us for the next Fresh Air.